Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 97.9 The Wren. The wake-up call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everyone. Thank you for being with us once again. Sunday morning wake-up call with the pleasure of being on The Wren. Our show today is about global health. Our guest, Dr. Catherine Quissel, an assistant professor at UVA's Department of Public Health Sciences, where she is the Global Public Health Program Director. Good morning, Dr. Quissel.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I feel honored to have you here with us today. Somebody to help us learn and become a little more enlightened about some of the questions that we don't always get to ask and don't always get to hear about. So let's just jump right in this. So much of the news that we hear about today has to do about issues within the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're just talking about COVID, even if we just limit it to that, and certainly there are much more grand issues, what's going on in the rest of the world with global health?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I will say that pretty much everywhere, COVID-19 has been monopolizing significant attention. That's where a lot of the work that the World Health Organization is doing is very much geared towards pandemic response and management, but also keeping in mind that the other health issues that were really important before the pandemic are still present and are still very, very important. But it has been hard because a lot of resources have been sent away from some of those other issues and reallocated towards COVID-19. But generally speaking, before the pandemic, a lot of the world's attention was oriented around the Sustainable Development Goals, which were decided in 2015, and they had set, benchmark goals for countries to achieve health improvements by the year 2030. And so the pandemic has very much disrupted a lot of those other efforts. And so there were continuing programs working on, HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, in addition to chronic illnesses. And a lot of those resources have, again, been shifted. So it's been challenging to keep up with everything that's going on in global health, given just how disruptive the pandemic is.
What is the current image of the World Health Organization in the global sense? Because you, in the United States, it hasn't had the best reputation within the last year and a half, mm-hmm. at least the way it's been presented in our news.
Yeah, and I think that when you look at the World Health Organization's history, it's always been a very important organization, but it's also a very underfunded organization. So it was established around the end of World War II, like many of the United Nations organizations, and it was given the responsibility for global health governance. But it's never really been funded and empowered to really be able to fulfill that role. And it's always played a really large role in governing emerging infectious diseases. It's the organization responsible for the international health regulations, which is the primary global treaty that we have that's supposed to try to organize country surveillance and timely reporting so that we can say, respond really early and aggressively to prevent these pandemics from, turning into true global pandemics. And I think that's where you saw many of the shortcomings of the organization, the fact that it had been underfunded for so long, that many of these capacities for doing, good disease surveillance and for getting data and information from countries that are supposed to report to it, they weren't in place. So they didn't have the resources there. It also tends to function under are voluntary agreements. The international health regulations, they don't have a strong enforcement clause or mechanism, which means that countries abide by it voluntarily. And so when China first, got wind of these, new infections in Wuhan, it delayed reporting to the World Health Organization for about a month. And there wasn't much the WHO could do about it. And so again, countries sort of act in a voluntary way following WHO guidance. So without having, greater enforcement powers, it also means that it's pretty constrained in what it can do. But globally, I'd say outside of the United States, it has a much better reputation because it's much more directly involved in providing technical support and guidance to low and middle income countries. The World Health Assembly that meets every May, there, every country sends representatives. And so it functions on a one country, one vote system. And so that means that lower middle income countries get much more representation and oversight over what the organization pays attention to. So other countries in the world, I think, value it much more so. But it's also, it's very easy to find things to criticize. It's not a perfect organization. And so I think a lot of discussions right now are looking at, what role should it play moving forward? Are there ways that we can strengthen it? Or are there other systems or institutions that should be responsible for carrying out these functions that the WHO is supposed to be doing?
So you say that the World Health Organization is not well funded. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and there's a couple factors related to it. So the World Health Organization, it has a primary budget that it gets from member states. So there are commitments that member states make to give the World Health Organization funding for its regular programs and its regular budget. And that's the budget that the World Health Assembly and the Executive Board has control over. But a lot of donors like the U.S. government and the Gates Foundation, they give money to the WHO, even more money through earmarked sort of external budgetary programs, which tend to go towards single issue campaigns like the Rollback Malaria campaign. The United States has been a big funder of Rollback Malaria and also polio eradication efforts. And so we give them money and we earmark it so they can only use it for polio or only use it for malaria. And so in the face of a pandemic, they don't have a lot of money just sitting around that they can move around quickly and reallocate. So if you look at the total size of their budget, I mean, their budget is much smaller than the Gates Foundation. It's much smaller than the amount of money the World Bank gives every year to health. So if you just look at it comparatively, it's, very underfunded in comparison to other actors in global health.
You also made mention that the World Health Organization is set up through voluntary participation, that it's one country, one vote. And if the United States, as an example, is giving a significant amount of money, even if it's just for, I can't remember the phrase you used, but for single issues, medical issues to deal with, is the one country, one vote setup bothersome to some countries?
Yeah, I think what you're getting at too is that there's some tensions in the governance of World Health Organization and the leverage that donors have over the work that it does. So within the World Health Assembly, that one country, one vote, again, gives them control over the regular budget. And in that way, lower and middle income countries are able to sort of steer and guide the work of the WHO and the use of those, regular budgetary funds. But donors do have much more control over those single issue programs or those external budgetary programs. And so when, under the Trump administration, when the United States government withdrew from WHO, you know, the money that it didn't pay in, not only did it not pay in resources that would go to the regular budget, but it, in many of those earmarked programs lost funding as well. And so in that way, the United States does have more power or control over the institution because we are its largest donor, next to the Gates Foundation, too. They're another major donor to the World Health Organization. So it's not, I think, accurate to say that, you know, all countries have an equal voice at the WHO, even though it does have that built into the design of the World Health Assembly.
Again, our guest today, Sunday morning wake-up call, as we talk about global health issues with Professor and Dr. Catherine Quissel. Professor, we're talking about global health here, but let's bring in the COVID-19 issue. When you look at past pandemics, for whatever the percentage of spread throughout the world, they seem to have come about in a different manner, if I'm correct. They have spread at a different rate. Mm-hmm. They start typically or often in third world countries first. And COVID-19 has sort of turned that on its head. It's spread more quickly. It has started in the wealthier countries, I guess, first world countries. Can you talk about why that would happen? What has created these discrepancies?
Yeah, with different emerging pathogens, I mean, many of them begin as pathogens found in animal species, and they make the jump into humans. And so a lot of the ones that you've seen, even going back to the 1918 flu, which they actually think started in rural United States, although it's been hard to know definitively how that pandemic started, has come from, you know, human proximity to certain animal species. You know, Ebola in Central Africa, linked to bats, even SARS-1 in China, they think originated in bats. SARS-2, they haven't been able to yet identify the animal host or the source of the pathogen. But usually the way that they, you know, make the leap into human populations is either through, you know, agricultural practices, human proximity to these different animal species. I think with the sort of first identified case in the West African Ebola outbreak, that it was a young boy who had maybe come in contact with a dead bat. So there's lots of ways that it, you know, these pathogens can jump into human hosts. And then I think when you look at what happens after that, it has a lot to do with the nature of the pathogen itself and just how it transmits, how transmissible it is, but also to human behavior. And when you have, say, a pathogen emerge in rural Central Africa, it may not find many other humans to transmit to. Whereas if you have a pathogen emerge in China, which is, you know, very densely populated, you might see, you know, increased chance for human-to-human transmission. And so there are a lot of circumstances like that that shape the trajectory of these emerging diseases.
Well, tell me more about what else. Again, so many of us just watch the news here in the United States, and what we see, and we'll get to it throughout the hour, is here's what's going on in our city, our county, mm-hmm. other states in the United States as the percentages rise and fall and the decisions that go with those. But what's going on outside of the United States that is different? Are other countries experiencing this vaccine hesitancy mm-hmm. that the United States is experiencing?
Yeah, and I think you've got a couple of questions in there. So I think one, when this, you know, looking at sort of broadly speaking what's going on in other countries, most countries outside of high income, so the United States, Canada, Europe, don't have much vaccine access yet. So the question of vaccine hesitancy is not at the forefront for them. It's still very much about, can we get any vaccines at all? So when you look at high-income countries, vaccine hesitancy, I would say historically has always been an issue. I think all of these other pandemics, and when you're dealing with infectious diseases, they're really scary. And the conditions that we have been living under the pandemic, I think it, you know, it's sort of ripe for spreading of misinformation because people are afraid and they don't know, you know, what to trust or believe. And so I think all of those factors can fuel distrust, and that can lead to things like vaccine hesitancy. I would also say that it's particularly pronounced now in the United States. It seems to have gotten worse over time. And there, you know, potentially specific political factors and other things driving vaccine hesitancy here. But other countries in Europe are seeing it too. France has, over the last decade or so, there's a lot of, you know, public opinion polling data from France that shows, you know, pretty high levels of vaccine hesitancy and anti-vax attitudes there as well. And they're currently seeing that play out in their own country because they've also had pretty good access to vaccines. And to the point where the French president has set up vaccine passports, basically saying that if you're not vaccinated, you cannot go to cafes, you can't go to a bunch of types of businesses, go on airplanes and things like that. And so they're starting to impose more rigorous mandates to try to boost vaccination rates. And so the hesitancy issue, I think, will be present in most places, particularly those that have the vaccines present. But when you start looking at sub-Saharan Africa, other places where they've only immunized, you know, 1-3% of their population, that's not the major issue right now.
I read some article where the phrasing used was that vaccine hesitancy is actually a privilege, because not all countries, as you mentioned, even have enough vaccines available to make that choice.
Yeah, and I think behind that too, there's some evidence, or at least there's some discussion about, you know, what factors contribute to hesitancy. And, you know, one of the theories proposed is that in high income nations, we have not had this direct experience with infectious diseases that are present still in many low and middle income countries. You know, we no longer have polio, we no longer have yellow fever, we no longer have these other pathogens that used to be just unbelievably harmful. But many African nations are still dealing with yellow fever, still dealing with, you know, a ton of malaria. And so that it's our sort of unfamiliarity with infectious disease that makes us forget how dangerous they are. Meanwhile, when you look at vaccines, you know, no vaccine is 100% effective or 100% without, you know, side effects or other risks. And so people do those risk calculations without fully understanding the risks of infectious disease. And some people might think, oh, well, a vaccine, if there's risks involved, then I just don't want to do it. So I think that there might be one factor driving hesitancy. I think there are other factors there as well, but that can certainly be one.
Why do you think that, well, you know what, let's take a break. And when we come back, let's get into the topic of, I think what I read as it called vaccine equity, with availability difference between, I guess, the more upper level countries, the G7 countries, and hoarding and other similar issues. So let's take our break. We'll come back and talk with Dr. Catherine Quissel, Assistant Professor, Global Health Program Director at UVA's Department of Public Health Sciences. And here we are, Sunday morning wake up call, learning about global health issues. Dr. Catherine Quissel here with us, UVA's Department Public Health Sciences. Dr. Quissel, vaccine equity was a phrase that I read about. Can you explain that, a little better definition than I would give?
Sure. So the idea behind vaccine equity, it's really a way of discussing just the vast disparities in access and the inequities that we're seeing now. One of the, I guess, approaches to vaccines that the WHO, the World Health Organization, has been promoting is this idea that if we had more equity in vaccine distribution, that not only would it be, you know, promoting those values of equity, but it would actually be doing a better job at beating back this global pandemic. So if you think about vaccine access in the United States here, we have, you know, more than enough vaccine doses for Americans. In fact, we purchased more than was necessary to vaccinate our population. Meanwhile, most countries in sub-Saharan Africa didn't begin getting vaccine deliveries until the summer, and they've only been able to immunize a very, very small percentage of their populations. The World Health Organization sees this inequity as problematic, again, just for the principles of equity, but also because many people are still very vulnerable in these countries. And without access, they're much more likely to die of COVID-19 in the interim because it's going to take such a long time to get the vaccines that they need. And so there, they're really promoting this idea that if the world had come together to better coordinate and organize vaccine purchasing and distribution, that the way to approach it would have been to basically take, you know, like the tiers that we went through, but to do that around the world, so that the first tier of individuals would have been healthcare providers and all people above a certain age range with underlying health risks, that around the world we immunize those individuals first. And then we go and begin immunizing, you know, the other tiers of individuals. Instead, what you saw was high-income country governments basically outbidding and contracting to purchase these vaccine doses to cover their entire populations first, without really a thought to vaccine access in other places.
So why are vaccines hoarded by the wealthier countries first rather than the sharing aspect? What are your thoughts on that?
I think there are several main drivers of it. So I think one factor that's really important to consider is the first, you know, several waves of the pandemic hit high-income countries harder, and we had way more mortality, way more cases. So I think that that created a really strong impetus for governments of these countries to do whatever they can to both save their citizens, but also to help their economies that were hit because of the different public health restrictions put in place. But also just general sort of restricted movement of individuals because of the crisis situation we were all living under. So I think that the fact that high-income countries suffered the early waves of the pandemic created those incentives for governments to sort of see to themselves first. If you think about it from the, you know, political perspective. If you're the leader of a country and your country's in really bad shape, you're going to do whatever you can to fix that. And I think what is somewhat unexcusable, though, is that countries were negotiating and trying to get vaccine doses for themselves. They could have also thought about global equity at the same time, but they didn't. They were too busy trying to, you know, cover their own population's interests. And it wasn't until later where, you know, when our crisis started to subside, that people started to look at it and say, yes, we should have paid greater attention. We should have negotiated for doses to donate to these global platforms, or we should have negotiated for countries to donate to the African Union, but we didn't do it at the time. So I think it's part of the nature of, you know, crisis response, but also some of the political incentives for governments to take care of themselves first.
Well, I found this little tidbit of information, a current discrepancy between some of the wealthier and poorer countries. Haiti has 500,000 doses for a population of over 11 million. Canada has 10 plus doses per resident. Mm-hmm. 80% of the doses have gone to people in high income and upper middle income countries. 1% The people in low-income countries have been given at least one dose. Are other countries similar to the United States with an excess of vaccines due to disinterest? I mean, we've actually had some thrown away because they expired, correct?
Yeah, well, we are. I think that we're approaching many of the expiration dates. So I think it's within the next month to 3 months, we're going to see many of the doses that we have procured expiring. And I think that other countries, you know, Canada certainly overpurchased, and we can maybe talk about why that happened too in a little bit. I've not heard as much about waste in other places, but I think it's certainly one of those risks. There are many countries that purchased more than they needed, or they purchased maybe enough, but then sort of misunderstood the degree of demand for the vaccines, given the amount of vaccine hesitancy that we've talked about. And I think that is really concerning that, you know, we've had high-income countries hoarding, and then we also have potential for significant waste. So the World Health Organization has been calling on these governments to do what they can to donate extra doses. What's complicated about that is that once you've purchased, and at least in the United States, all of these doses have been distributed out. You know, they're at local pharmacies, they're out in like local health districts. And so then, you know, asking people to somehow, you know, recollect, reassemble, and then donate doses, it's very complex, and it's legally complex. There's a lot of hurdles to go through in terms of ensuring, you know, proper temperature control, and that it hasn't spoiled, and that the quality is still high. And so some people are saying that we don't have the time to donate our extra doses because they will spoil before we're able to do that. So in the interim, I think what that means is, you know, doing what we can to drive up vaccination in the United States. But I think, you know, taking lessons from this for future pandemic planning, to realize that, you know, we need to be considering vaccine dosages for other countries while we are also, you know, purchasing and creating systems for vaccine delivery here in the United States.
Again, our guest today, as we talk about global health issues, is Dr. Catherine Quissel. She's the Global Public Health Program Director at UVA's Department of Public Health Sciences. Dr. Quissel, I heard that the World Health Organization recently called for a moratorium on vaccine booster shots. Mm-hmm. Why would they do that?
Yeah, this is a really interesting topic. It's become a big conversation piece over the last couple of weeks. So their big concern, again, is that, you know, the United States and other high-income countries, we have the ability to outbid other countries because we can pay higher prices per unit for vaccines. So that if we were to, you know, start up an aggressive booster shot campaign for our entire population, where we would need to then go out and purchase additional doses, we would literally be taking vaccines away from other countries who still do not have enough to vaccinate their population once. So they see that as, you know, a significant ethical issue that they're discouraging countries from doing. They did say, and they made it more specific, that, you know, if you have as a country these excess doses that otherwise would spoil, or if you're going to use them to boost peoples who are, you know, immunocompromised, who might not have had as strong of an immune response to the two-dose regimen, they don't have an issue with that. Their concern is, again, with countries going out and purchasing vaccines, which are still a somewhat scarce resource, that would then take away those vaccines from other countries.
Did the pandemic striking the G7 countries, Europe and the U.S. and first world countries, did that, I mean, you mentioned that they overbid, or maybe that wasn't the word you chose, but they maybe overpurchased. Is that what caused, not just caused them to have so many, but mm-hmm. I also read where that had something to do with the creation some laws were made preventing products and completed vaccines from leaving countries?
Well, I think that there are a couple issues there. So with the way that these vaccines were financed, to take, especially with the mRNA vaccines, you know, there had been research into mRNA as a technology for vaccine delivery, but it was really the investment of billions of dollars from governments, so the United States government, the Canadian government, European governments, that were able to turn this, you know, potential vaccine technology into a reality. And one of the financing mechanisms they used were these advanced purchasing agreements, where they would basically guarantee a market for these products, whether they worked or not. And that was a big, you know, financial incentive for these companies to, you know, bring these products to market and to be able to go through the clinical trial process and get the data that they need. And so in doing that, a lot of these governments set up these contracts with multiple companies for multiple different vaccines, because at that point, it was all uncertain whether any of them would be effective. And as it turned out, many of them were quite effective and very safe. Like, these are phenomenal vaccines. And so I think by accident, almost, you had countries who were investing to try to get the R&D going, now ended up with all of these vaccine dosages. Some of them were unnecessary, but they were trying to cover all of their bases in planning it. With the other issue, I think maybe what you're referring to is that, you know, through the Defense Production Act in the United States, other countries have laws of that nature where it sort of bans the export of materials during crisis situations. That's also meant that a lot of the ingredients for the production of these vaccines, you know, the supply chains are in the United States or they're in high-income countries. And so that also limits the production capacity to these nations, because other countries can't get access to the ingredients to be able to manufacture or produce these vaccines.
Right. They can't, if we can't allow developing world countries to create any vaccines on their own, because we're not only sharing completed vaccines, but we're not sharing materials for them to create their own, what kind of ethics is that?
And this has been one of the major debates going on now, and it's been ongoing for a long time, because if you look across the whole system of how we, you know, incentivize and support research and development, we pay very little attention to the access piece. And, you know, lower middle income countries have been fighting this, honestly, since the HIV/AIDS pandemic started back in the late 80s and early 90s, trying to figure out how you gain access to these life-saving technologies when you might be priced out because of how expensive they are when they finally come to market. But we also haven't invested in their own capacities for research and development. And what you're seeing right now with certain actions, like through the World Trade Organization, a large group of nations led by South Africa and India have proposed what's called the TRIPS waiver. And the idea here is that they're trying to waive some of the intellectual property protections given to companies through TRIPS, trade-related intellectual property, to basically say in a pandemic, we should not protect IP. We should share this information so that we can, you know, produce more of these vaccines and produce them in a way that countries won't get priced out of being able to access them. And, you know, they're seeing a lot of pushback to this TRIPS waiver proposal by the EU in particular. And so it's been an ongoing battle looking at these tensions between, you know, how you create protections for the innovators who produce these technologies, but how do you also then guarantee that the people who need them can get access to them? And it's that latter piece that our system has not really dealt with.
Why is it the EU in particular that's against the TRIPS waiver?
Yeah, a lot of these major pharmaceutical companies are headquartered in the US and in EU countries and Switzerland, since Switzerland's not a member of the EU. And so I think what's been interesting is that the United States actually, you know, expressed support for the TRIPS waiver. And that was, I think, more of a surprise than the EU fighting the TRIPS waiver, because usually the United States stands on the side of protecting intellectual property rights, not waiving them. And so I think with the Biden administration, you know, they expressed support for, you know, negotiating written language around the waiver. It's difficult at this point to know if their support was just symbolic or, you know, signaling that, you know, we are concerned with access, you know, and if they actually would have followed through on it. But the EU is setting up a pretty significant barrier, because the way that the World Trade Organization works, with these types of, you know, waivers or protocols, it would be based on consensus, and they would need all member states to agree to it. So as long as the EU fights it, it's unlikely to see any sort of major changes through the World Trade Organization.
I'm looking this up, and a majority, over 100 low-income countries, are in support of TRIPS, but the EU, the United Kingdom, which has left the EU, Japan, Canada, Australia, all oppose TRIPS. Why would Australia and Japan oppose TRIPS? Do they have any of the companies that that are involved in these vaccines have a part of those countries?
Yeah, and so for those countries, they'd be opposed to the TRIPS waiver, not to TRIPS itself, because TRIPS was the treaty that basically created uniform IPRs, or intellectual property rights. So I think what they're really doing is defending sort of like the TRIPS status quo. And so I would say that for both Australia and Japan, they have a smaller pharmaceutical industry, but they also, I think, consider themselves to be part of the sort of innovation economy. And that, you know, intellectual property here, we're talking about it just as it applies to access to medicines or to medical technologies. But intellectual property rights apply to a whole range of products and processes and things like that. So I think what many of these countries are concerned about, it could be specifically related to, you know, protecting their pharmaceutical sectors, but it's, you know, I think always this concern about what sort of precedent are we setting for intellectual property. Do we want to set a precedent where we can just waive, you know, intellectual property protections to, you know, guarantee access to this product? And so they might just be hesitant at doing anything that would weaken IPRs as a whole.
Where do you see this going if the EU is against the TRIPS waiver and the United States has come out and said, whether symbolically or actually, that they are for it?
I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of meaningful action on the TRIPS waiver, which I think is unfortunate, because I think that it should be part of a broader conversation about, you know, how we can fix this global system to better deliver these goods that people need. But I'm not sure it's going to happen. And, you know, right now it just keeps, the conversation keeps getting pushed back. And so I think there's, I mean, one of my concerns is that even if something were to happen, it might be too late for helping to manage the pandemic right now. I mean, we're seeing, you know, these exponential increase in cases across many countries around the world, not just in the United States. And by the time that you were to work out an agreement around waiving IP, in the time it takes in to make the vaccines, I'm just not sure that that is going to help us currently.
Again, our guest today is Dr. Catherine Quissel from UVA's Department of Public Health Sciences. As we talk about global health issues, we'll be right back. And we're back with Dr. Quissel here talking about global health issues. She's the Global Public Health Program Director at UVA. So, Dr. Quissel, we talked a little bit earlier about the difficulty in the United States gathering up already distributed vaccines to donate them. Mm-hmm. Right? Can you tell me about the Coalition for Epidemic preparedness and innovations and what that is.
Yeah, so CEPI is an international organization. It's a partnership. I believe the Norwegian government was one of the primary founders of it, but it's a public-private partnership that has been working on pandemic preparedness. And part of what they do is, you know, try to invest in strategies to help with pandemic response. And so CEPI has been engaged with a lot of the vaccines that have been produced. You know, they helped to fund, they gave money to Moderna for Moderna's mRNA vaccine. CEPI also helped the World Health Organization establish the COVAX facility, which was, again, supposed to be a centralized, you know, procurement and distribution center for purchasing vaccines for the world and then distributing them to all countries that join the facility. So CEPI has been engaged in all of those activities. So it has been, you know, very concerned with vaccine equity and access, and has played a role in many of those major initiatives. So a lot of what they've been doing, though, it's not necessarily about donations, but it is about, you know, procurement and purchasing doses, or getting countries to pledge support and then give money or support to COVAX, or getting high-income countries to purchase doses on behalf of COVAX or to donate the doses that they already have purchased to the COVAX facility. Does that make sense?
It does. But how are... If a country wanted to go out and make a purchase today, say any country wanted to go out and buy 1 million doses, is Moderna going to sell to the highest bidder? Are they going to sell to the first in the queue?
I think what we've seen is that I think the queue has been the primary sort of organizational structure. So it might be based on timing, but also a little bit about the amount of money that you're bringing to the table, because that gives you negotiating power. So earlier on, you know, I think the United States kind of set the pace and the tone because we were sort of first out of the gate in creating these advanced purchasing agreements and spending billions of dollars on, you know, financing these vaccines and then, you know, committing money to saying, like, we will buy them from you, whether they're effective or not. You know, thank goodness that they are very, very effective. But at that point, I think the COVAX facility had gotten off the ground and it had received pledges from countries but didn't actually have financial resources. So it had no money to spend. So it couldn't really negotiate contracts with companies to purchase doses until it actually started to receive money from the donor countries. Meanwhile, I think other countries in Europe saw what the United States was doing and basically quickly did the same thing, purchasing on behalf of their own individual countries. Meanwhile, lower income nations, they had been, you know, they had joined the COVAX facility. I think they were waiting to see what COVAX was going to do. And when then they saw COVAX not delivering, they began to work out their own agreements. So the African Union has been negotiating for the continent. Individual African countries have been negotiating with other companies to purchase vaccines for themselves. And they're able to get them at lower prices than we've paid here in the United States. But at that point, you could see that they've already come in like pretty far back in the queue. And without having sufficient capacity to produce all of those vaccines, you know, they're waiting for them.
So let's go back. I'll mention Haiti again. Third world country, mentioned earlier in the show, only 500,000 doses for a population of over 11 million. At least that was a statistic that I think from earlier in July of this year. Can, if the United States is earlier, is ahead of them in the queue, should ethics bound in the conversation that's being had, are more people stating that the United States should get their own and bring it in for the U.S. citizens, or that they should take what's theirs in the queue and send them to somebody else like Haiti?
Yeah, I think right now, well, the United States has done a couple of different things. So when the Biden administration took over, you know, we had purchased a bunch of the AstraZeneca vaccine that still is not approved here. And so that we've donated. The Biden administration's also purchased, I think it was like something like 500 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine specifically for lower and middle income countries. So, you know, our government already has gone out and tried to procure or purchase additional vaccines for other places. But if you think about it, I think that the estimate is that the world needs like 11 billion vaccine doses to get around 70% of people immunized. Like 500 million sounds like a lot, but it's still a very small drop in the bucket of the vaccines that are needed for global vaccination. And so I think what the argument is that, you know, more doses need to be procured for lower middle income countries. That means that high income nations do have to step up and help with those financial resources. But we also have to increase production because other countries in Africa, for example, are willing to pay for them and have some money to purchase them. But we don't have the vaccine doses for them yet because they haven't yet been made. And so we also have to talk about the supply chain of ingredients and the manufacturing capacities and how we continue to ramp those up to meet global needs and demands while also dealing with the financing piece.
You mentioned the Biden administration. My understanding is that they made their pledge to provide 80 million doses abroad by the end of June. Mm-hmm. And by mid-July, 44 million doses had been sent. So they were short by nearly half. Mm-hmm. And of the 44 million, 2.5 million were sent to Canada, which has already given at least one dose to more of its population than any other country. And Africa has yet to receive its doses from the United States.
Yeah, and I think what that demonstrates is that the sort of process of donating the doses that we've already purchased for ourselves that we might have, you know, physically stored here in the U.S., it's very slow. And I certainly think that we should be looking at these systems for how we ensure safety and the quality of these products will also speeding up the pace at which these donations are occurring. But part of it, I think, is also, on the other hand, you know, a lot of countries who've been making pledges and saying, we're going to give this to COVAX or we're going to donate this to your country. Part of the problem is also, again, in the supply chain and in the actual production, that they might be saying that we are getting these for you, but they don't, those vaccines don't actually exist yet. And the timelines are more extended than they would have liked. Because when you look at sort of the reality of the situation, you've had issues where, you know, manufacturing facilities have spoiled doses. And so we thought we were going to have X million vaccines and then we don't. Or, you know, you had major production of the AstraZeneca vaccine happening in India. And then they had that massive surge because of the Delta variant. And so then a lot of the vaccine that they had promised to COVAX and to sell in other places, they then used for domestic purposes. So you also had these massive interruptions to the supply of vaccines.
Right. I read where India ordered that the country's manufacturers ordered them to stop exporting COVID-19 vaccines. And that's where over 50% of the world's vaccine doses are actually made.
Yeah. And a lot of those, like Africa was really relying almost entirely on the vaccine doses being produced out of the Serum Institute in India.
Did India receive any backlash from other countries for such a decision?
I think there was some, but I think it also, and this is what's so tricky about it, I think people also understand the crisis that they were facing and the pressures that, you know, Indian political leaders were under from their citizens by having pledged all of these doses when there still was really insufficient, you know, domestic vaccination in India. From what I've heard, since most of my research right now is in Eastern Africa, from, you know, countries across the African continent was that they were always somewhat uncomfortable with relying on India for that very reason. They were afraid of something like that happening. They've been trying to like diversify the vaccines that they have access to. But as we've been talking about, it's been very challenging for all the other reasons. Yeah.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Catherine Quissel, as we talk about global health issues. So, Dr. Quissel, whether it was India during its time and its choice to prevent exporting of completed vaccines, or Eastern Africa, are any of the G7 countries assisting these other countries, if not in giving them vaccines, if not in making of vaccines? Are they assisting them in distribution of vaccines and actually helping get the vaccines out to the individuals?
That's a really good question. So actually what we've seen with the money that the Biden administration reallocated to purchase those additional doses, those 500 million doses or whatever the total number was, they took money that they had been sort of set aside to help with the vaccine delivery and put it towards, vaccine purchasing. And so there still is very much a shortfall in funding or financing to help these countries with the actual delivery on the ground. And we know it with the mRNA vaccines, the refrigeration requirements, and that's very challenging. It was challenging for us at the beginning. And so right now in many countries, I think of like Nigeria in particular, they've got major hospital centers in their urban areas who have the refrigeration and cold storage requirements for having the mRNA vaccines, but they have no real way of getting those vaccines out of these major hospital centers. So there are a lot of hurdles still when it comes to actually getting vaccines into arms. And we've still pretty much set it up as a sort of like donation-based system. We haven't really transferred technology, intellectual property, any of the information or ingredients for manufacturing on the African continent. There was a tech transfer hub set up in South Africa that no mRNA company is participating in yet. So Africa is still reliant basically on these vaccines coming in from Europe or from other places in the form of donations.
So, Professor, we got about 5 minutes left. I want to ask you whether you need to speak for yourself personally or whether you can speak as the Global Public Health Program Director at UVA. Can you talk about your thoughts on the global vaccine passport and some of the other decisions, whether it's Florida arguing against a vaccine passport of some type to get on the cruise ships. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier France and their health pass to get into museums and cafes, New York City now having a requirement for indoor dining, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about those things?
Yeah, I'll give you my personal assessment on it, but maybe we can also approach it in the way that I would, in the class that I teach for the Global Public Health Program. One of the things I always talk about with my students is that when you think through these decision scenarios, and you've been mentioning this a lot too, it's how you analyze the ethics and the ethical trade-offs of how to approach the situation. So when you think of something like having to demonstrate proof of immunization in order to do certain things, the ethics in favor of an action like that are that it helps protect public safety, public health, and public welfare. We're talking about an infectious disease. And so if someone is going out in public places and isn't wearing a mask and is in an enclosed environment, that they're putting people around them at risk. And so that by, guaranteeing that people who are in these public places are immunized, that you are benefiting public welfare. The counter to that is that you are potentially restricting the movement of people who don't have that proof of vaccination. And so you have to look at it and say, is this trade-off worth it? My opinion is that it is worth it, that it benefits, you know, public health and safety, but it also has a lot of economic benefits, that it makes it a lot easier for businesses and schools to stay open if we know that the people going there are immunized. So, you know, all of these countries are dealing with different politics around it and different consequences around it. But I'm in favor of policies that, you know, work towards mandating vaccination coverage, or that create incentives that dramatically, you know, increase the rates of vaccination, which is what needs to happen right now.
We've seen more, not to take sides, but we've certainly seen more and more folks in the Republican Party, leaders in the Republican Party, come out and say, now's the time to get vaccinated as the Delta variant has become stronger in their states. And we have seen, we still seem to have a general 50%. Theoretically, split in the school systems with between the parents the citizens into which business and your beliefs on where you want to go. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and this is some of the trickier political consequences of living in a very polarized environment right now. Is, you know, when I look at some of these debates around things like masks and mask mandates, I mean, honestly, I just think that asking people to wear a mask is such a small thing. I don't buy the argument that it's somehow a violation of liberty of any kind. I mean, it's an inconvenience, it's uncomfortable, but it's not an infringement on any of your rights or freedoms. And in fact, it facilitates rights and freedoms in a pandemic, because then you can go about and do things more safely while protecting the well-being of your neighbors. But it's become so politicized and so partisan that it's almost become symbolic, that people aren't really looking at it in terms of its merits. It just becomes a symbol of what side you're on. It does make me nervous when we think about schools coming back in August, that children under 12 are completely unimmunized, that you would, you know, not allow mask mandates in schools, like some of these states are deciding. It seems totally absurd to me, because what you're going to be doing is introducing greater uncertainty and risk into your schools. So I think that this is, again, one of the consequences of, you know, political polarization in our country.
We got about 30 seconds left. Where do you see us in 1 year?
Ooh, that is a tough question. I mean, I think thankfully so far, these vaccines have been remarkably effective against any of the virus so far. And I hope that that continues to be the case, and that we continue to immunize, and that by this time next year, we are back to more of a normal. That's my optimistic take. And I think it's what I would most likely predict. But, you know, the variants are always a curveball. But as long as we can sort of stay on top of public health mitigation, and scientists are studying it, I feel confident that we'll be able to continue to manage. But again, get vaccinated.
Our guest today, Dr. Catherine Quissel. She's the assistant professor, a global public health program director at UVA's Department of Public Health Sciences. Doctor, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, have a great Sunday, and we'll see you next week.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.